happen, whatever you have available. And then you search around everywhere for it until you get it together.
I think trying to make people think in terms of unity, and just in thinking in terms of wholeness instead of separativeness.
And it's how you deal with the parts, not necessarily defining each part exactly. The better you understand parts, fine, but you've still got to mess around with them and see how they relate to each other and how they can be made to.
And the more cases you consider, the larger your frame of reference gets to be, the less precise you can be. Wouldn't you say that? In other words,
except
you can't talk.
Sometimes, if you pick one here, one there, and one off in someplace else, you can be very precise when you're finished.
That's pretty good.
It seems like maybe the problem is a matter of preciseness of definitions, but Bucky is trying to get away from people using words in such ways that they continue with misconceptions, like the idea of line versus, you know, wave motion. It's easy if you're using sort of commonplace words to maintain old ideas that aren't right, or according to present conceptions are right. It's very hard to get away from this if you keep using these old words.
That one seems to be basically a disagreement with mathematics or mathematicians, in the sense that people thinking they're making physical reality that corresponds to the line or corresponds to some of these other things. But I think most mathematicians readily agree with this. They will call these abstractions and approximations. It's more like that we have certain habits of using particular approximations, particular abstractions, and he's saying that others would be more fruitful to use. I think that's really what it comes down to, but maybe we've got somebody here who knows a lot more about it than
I get the idea that Bucky would prefer we didn't play games. Just because we could play games, we should work on things.
Just think on a larger scale. And larger, not just larger in your head, but larger in unity, of everything. Your interaction with everything and everybody, of creation, of existence.
Do this as well as we can, rather than just playing games with things that we've decided, well, we could do this and we could do that, but if we see that things work this way, if I were going to invent something, I wouldn't put a lot of mythical things together, but I'd see what was there and what I could do with that.
It seems like the fundamental thing he's talking about is, and again, as Dr. Janot has pointed out, there may be a problem in interpreting these terms, the difference between rationalism and empiricism. Talking about empiricism in terms of actually your sense experience, observing natural phenomena, versus the rationalistic or the idealistic like mathematics, in that when you go out and observe nature, you try to describe it, you try to categorize and say this is a moose and that's a dog and this is an atom and that's a star, and then you try to find lawful relationships between these different types of things. Well, in mathematics, we don't worry about what the types of things are. All we do is we have interrelationships. And mathematics says, okay, here is an interrelationship, which is very simple and very elegant, which seems to at least approximate the interrelationships which we appear to be observing in nature. So we will describe them this way. And if you're good at both the empiricism and the mathematics, if you can both observe nature and look at your description and keep working on it, then you try to get your description where it very, very closely corresponds to what you're trying to describe. It functions as a model. The problem is that you have people up here who specialize in mathematics and never worry about your empirical things, your experience. And because what you experience may not be as pretty and as elegant as their ideas, well, they don't want to go along with it. They have different sets of values. The guy who's the empiricist and is looking at nature has a very limited capability for describing what he's seen. I spent 2 summers out watching the behavior of moose. trying to describe their vocalizations and their movements and all sorts of things. And I'll tell you, it is bloody hard to find a way to put things into words. And, you know, that's done on the empirical level. And maybe if I knew more mathematics and more linguistics and a few other things, I would find it easier. But we have two leanings in science very strongly. Some people talk about exact sciences. Well, they sometimes sacrifice the exactness for the empirical quality. People who want pretty descriptions, because the description's down there in paper where everybody can see it. You're judged on your description. Nobody else has looked at what you're describing, so they don't know how closely your description fits what you're saying. And I get an impression of a lot of what Buckminster was trying to say was that we've got to break out of the habits of using traditional descriptions which don't fit. We have to go back and look at the phenomena, and if they don't fit, try to describe them better as our understanding changes. Sunset and sunrise. He says that's not a very good description of what's actually happening. Sunclipse and sunsight would be better.
I think that's a good idea to attempt to review, if nothing else, to attempt to rephrase in our own words what he has had to say and see how far we can agree between one another. Steve's referring to Dr. Janot reminded me that I should tell you why I think it's Mr. Janot is better, because I think, to me, a doctor refers to somebody who treats ill people, and I feel at the university that a PhD can be Mr. So-and-so who treats healthy people, and there are many cases where PhDs are embarrassed to answer midnight calls for delivering babies, and especially, you know, when they're so proud that they put their PhD and doctor in the phone book. Another thing that occurs to me with respect to Steve, and we can let this remain a mystery, but let me tell you that I'm interested to hear your comments about Bacon, for instance. And we have a great need, I think, for more history of science. But there are some other even greater needs, and these tie into things that Bucky and Herman Wolf are interested in. Herman's not here, are you, Herman? Waiting for him to sneak in. I trust he's not stuck somewhere, you know. Actually, the parking out back of this building isn't so bad. He went up there and got in just fine. I'm presently trying to engage in conversations and some kind of contest. Not a contest. Conversation. There's a messy word, but there's... I enjoy, as Bucky says, a large lag. If there's a good question asked, I can usually find a pretty good answer the next day, which is awful hard for rap sessions. But we could very well use, I think, at this university, a good course in humanities. And if one looks at the old catalog, in which there is a description of a course that has never been offered here but is offered in Anchorage, it includes the humanities course. It was listed for the second year level, which is probably wrong. It should be given at the first year level when a student comes in is interested in and probably in need of getting a comprehensive view. And the humanities, as listed in the new catalog for Anchorage, I presume, I think includes music and art and literature, and winds up, I think, with some kind of short of the whole with philosophy. Yeah, Terry?
I'd like to comment on this, if I might.
Mr. Chico, remember, how do you feel?
Well,
I think
yeah.
I'll offer a clinical thermometer the next time.
This is a part of the cultural idea of what doctor means, and I am not... I don't think that the whole culture, myself included, feel that doctor means a physician. But as I was, you
trying to say. You were, right?
I was trying to say you. you mentioned that perhaps we should have this humanities course as a person becomes a freshman in college. I think.
Well, don't exclude the seniors because there's still hope.
I was going to say that it's very, very helpful when you have some background in something else. For instance, I've taken 4 years of science and then I switched over, and I
switched over
into sort of philosophy and history and all sorts of things. And I find it's real helpful that what I've had before helps me understand what I'm doing now.
Let me see. Well, then where do you stand on this humanities idea?
Well, you mentioned that it should start out right at the beginning. I assume you... I know
you
that
agree?
You...
agree?
Well, no, I disagree. Well, I go along with that, but I just want to point out that afterwards, I mean, after you have something else first, there's a lot of advantages in that sort of approach.
Ah, but...
It seems like you're going backwards. I mean, you're learning about the basis for all your education the last year you're going to school. I mean, in college, you should be learning all these things in grade school. If from the time you're first born, when you're first growing up, going through, your parents should be teaching you the subtler things of life. You know, there's underlying possibilities.
Don't forget TV.
I'm not talking about, okay, TV too. Anything, any kind of education you like, but it should start in grade school to let a little kid know that there's more, you know, to tell him. Like he said, it's not sunrise and sunset. You don't tell the person that's a senior in high school or college that it's not sunrise, that it's you know, something else. I mean, you should start young. It shouldn't be the last year you're in school or college that you learn the basics for your entire learning. Yes, you just start with that and then build off of it.
Well, Bucky's idea is if you're 4 years old, it's too late already.
Then let's see, start early.
He started at 32, so we've got some
hope. Well, perhaps you could have different sections for the humanities course. You could have one section to be for incoming freshmen who are formulating their ideas about this, that, and the other, and another section for people who have, after they've studied for a while, and then maybe special sections for people who are more interested in certain disciplines. Have
just make sure that you have it specialized enough so that an expert teaches each course.
That'll fix it.
What do you mean, sorry?
No, don't be sorry. That put us on our mettle to get started without you, you know. It would have been so easy with you.
I was figuring you were going to do that. But I didn't mean it to be this long.
Oh, did you have trouble?
Okay.
The two members who have arrived tardily are Vic Fisher, who is sitting at the end of the couch over there on the floor. And Vic has been, is that right, the chairman of the Bartlett Lectures Committee. I don't know that we want to relinquish him because I feel that somehow he had the hotline and still has hotlines to many impressive people and people that are of interest to us in other parts of the world, and it was largely through his correspondence that the arrangements were made to get Bucky here. And then of course it was I volunteered while Vic was out of town to try and coordinate, and I didn't realize what I was getting into, but I've met about 500 new people, and we've got a good television circuit in the Wood Center now, and just a lot of benefits have been derived from it. Well, I think I've already mentioned that Herman Wolf is a 30-year associate of Bucky. He would be a good man to direct some questions to, not so much with regard to the technicalities of Bucky's talk, which I think we've been doing something with here before Herman came, although that's not excluded. But perhaps, obviously, something about Bucky himself and some of the problems, that's probably the thing to focus on, some of your your most current problems as to what to do with a man like Fuller. That's really what we're talking about. What can we do for ourselves, through ourselves, with the omniscience of Fuller? So,
could I ask a question?
I think it's about time, right?
Yeah.
But let's not.
Okay.
We have an inventor
my question
here.
Has to do with sort of behaviorism and social science. That's my specialty, so I'm no good at it. What it amounts to is that I'm sort of an amateur inventor myself. I come up with ideas, but I'm not very good at finding ways of getting people interested in them or getting them off the ground. I'd rather just sit back and have new ones. All right. If I want to get any of my stuff sold or accepted or whatever, what's the best way to do it? I knew one guy that spent 1 year trying to sell a single invention. He finally sold it to an AV company, and then they made him market it, so he spent the next year, 2 years on one invention, marketing his own thing, and he wasn't a salesman, he was an inventor. This has puzzled me. What do you do? Let's say you're starting
to say that I'm the person to ask. I suppose this depends as much on luck as anything else as to whether you follow through on your own or whether you're able to find some people who as the inventor you can keep a reasonable interest in it, in the potential, and they have a marketing apparatus. I don't know what else you could say. It all depends on what the invention is and where it's going and who's trying to steal it from you, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Every once in a while, I say to myself, I wonder if I could get paid to do this. And I have a friend who's into the same thing. Sometimes we get together and think up things. And he said, you know, I can't imagine anybody ever paying me to think. Because this is what he likes to do. And I've wondered, how do you get there?
Isn't that the idea, though, to get paid for what you were going to do anyway?
Yeah, that's the idea, to do something that's fun, that you like, and then find somebody to pay you to do it.
Well, I think a lot of people in today's world are getting paid to think, but I haven't been able to find out either.
What is your specialty?
Well, I guess it's public relations. At least that's what I've been doing. I got into it because I was lazy, I must admit. Because my first interest was in the labor movement. I'm talking in the early 30s. And it became quite obvious, either you were an organizer or you wrote press releases. And I'm not a very good salesman or organizer. And that's how I got into publicity and public relations. But I worked with Bucky in the 40s when he built the Dymaxion house out of Beach Aircraft in Wichita, Kansas. And then we sort of drifted apart, and fortunately for me, we drifted back together. I don't know what the discussions have been before I got here, but I think what set us up was that wherever Bucky goes, he gets this tremendous reception. And a few of us are trying to figure out, you know, what's the follow-up? Obviously, in the main, the follow-up is up to each of you. Too many people come running after him because they want him to solve their life problem. And this doesn't make sense. On the other hand, we have been talking about putting together certain materials and tapes and so on so that some follow-up could go on at the universities that want to.
after they've had this big dose of Fullerism and everybody's excited, and it's rather obvious that you get so many ideas thrown at you in a couple hours that then you're not sure which direction to go. And again, not that anyone can give you the answer, but I think there may be ways we can, that might be worked out. And this is what we were talking about before, which I don't know, maybe the way it gets worked out is by some continuing sessions up here. I shouldn't say up here. continuing sessions.
Why not?
Out here. And
out here. yeah, very good. Yeah, I understand. Yes.
You know, we've had one conversation on this with, I don't think Bucky had in his speech last night, a man and his wife, you know, sitting in the living room, and he's just learned he doesn't say up and down, so he says, "Dear, I'm going out to bed." And, you can take it from there. But the point is that what's going to develop is only going to develop through through people such as you.
Just before you arrive, you're talking about education. What does Mr. Fuller think of our present educational system?
He thinks it's obsolete. I don't know what books of his are in the bookstore here, but 10 years ago, when Southern Illinois University was setting up their new campus at Edwardsville, he gave a talk there, which is now a book called Education Automation. And I would suggest that some of you get a look at this, because this is an indication of his opinion on this subject. Just as he said last night, talking about the third parent in the home being television, young people today grow up learning far more from television than they do from their parents in most circumstances. The same thing follows, obviously, in school. You got teachers who either have tenure or they're busy writing books for PhDs, and the teaching part of school is something they just got to do, I taught this way last year, I'll teach it this way this year. And meanwhile, the students are far ahead of them. And half the things they're teaching aren't true anymore because of new breakthroughs. Certain plans underway now that I hope will be started by the fall in at least one university that where some of his basic ideas will be integrated throughout a large number of disciplines. And there's no reason, if there's a desire here among students and faculty, that the same thing couldn't be started here. But I didn't come in here as a revolutionist to tell anyone here what to do. The point is that I think from his book and from what you've heard from him, you can get the general drift of what direction one should be going. I heard one dean last night after the lecture say that he thought that Bucky's ideas should be integrated into the school, and many of the present courses dropped and changed around. But I'm not an educator, and I don't know which direction or how this is done without starting everything all over again.
I was just wondering, could you give us some insights? Obviously, he has a tremendous amount of information, and I was wondering how he's learned this information, from reading books, from talking with the nationally known specialists in the field, or from just talking to anybody. How does he learn? How does he understand?
Well, in the first place, he spent 45 years doing what he's doing. And so that from his own studying and his own work, he's been able to build up a tremendous fund of knowledge. At this point, there obviously are many important people that he comes in contact with a given and take. There are also many magazines and newspapers and books that come into his office that several people pull out important information to be of help to him.
Does he read rapidly or?
Nope.
Well?
Obviously well. But he does not, he's never bothered with any of the rapid reading courses. And I'd say he's a good example of the opposite. I don't know whether that idea of doing that ever occurred to him, but in any case, he doesn't.
What do you expect to work on?
I'm sorry, I can't hear.
Been working on a new book on mathematics. When do you expect that to come out?
Well, the chap who's working with him on that is working full time on it. And actually, this will be I think his most important book on synergetic geometry, because it's a basis for everything that he's ever developed. And I guess it'll be out sometime in late next year or early of 74.
Mention why it's not to use the word God, and he speaks of this. Do you have any idea why when he uses the word God, he speaks of this word as he? Do you have any reason why he does that?
No, I haven't. I don't know.
Oh, I know one thing. He refers to universe and brain. He doesn't put the in front of it. Is that just to save words, or he's in his book he just writes universe instead of the universe?
I couldn't answer.
Maybe since there's only one, universe is his name. So
yeah, but then there's
the John and the Mary and the Paul, and so you might as well say universe.
Getting back to your question earlier about material facts and so on.
Who are you referring to, me? Or no?
Well, no, just a gentleman mentioned. In the development, over the years, he's developed several volumes on world inventory resources. And these have been used in development of some of his material in studies of world game philosophy. And so there are several books that have come out of his office at Southern Illinois that which have pretty good basic facts covering many of the things that he talks about.
I think this is a point that I hadn't gotten to before I was started reserving it until you got here. Namely, a few people with whom I talked, a few students after the lectures, maybe I did mention, I guess, they wondered what the facts were, you know, how could you test the ideas of synergetics? And so you say this is a world resources inventory, right?
Yeah, there are about six or seven volumes that...
Has anybody seen those, or are they on campus, do you know? You have your own personal ones, or you've seen them? Okay.
I have a friend that sent for it.
Yeah. So that's something we could look into acquiring, certainly, because one of the first things would be to have a library that we could refer to, his writings, of course.
I think the Institute of Government Social and Economic Research down in college has this file that you're speaking of, has a startup.
Is that right? Did you hear that? The Institute of Social, Economic, and Government Resources? We better get you over.
All I hear is a coke machine.
Which brings up a question. Okay, we'll come back to that. Is there a better place that we could put Herman Wolf and a better way of centering this? I must say that we need the ventilation, but it takes a certain amount of noise pollution to do it, doesn't it?
Somebody went on for the coke machine.
It's an infinite machine. It doesn't shut off, so...
Do you know if there is down there a part of Bucky's world resources inventory in the Institute?
No, we don't have it.
I didn't want to negate what...
I thought it was an international resource inventory, not just one.
And not what?
And not just Bucky's. I thought it was an international inventory.
No, this is separate volume.
Whenever he speaks, he very often refers to his 32nd year as a very important year in his life.
To what year?
His 32nd year.
Yeah.
Can you tell us anything about what happened to him?
Yeah, this is the year he decided not to commit suicide. And this is in his writings. It was 1927. He had lost, he and his wife had lost their first daughter from illness. And his second daughter was born, and he was broke, living in Chicago, and contemplating the idea that if he did away with himself, they might be better off. And then he decided, fortunately for all of us, that that wasn't a good idea. And this is when he really retired from the world for 2 years and did a lot of studying, developed a lot of the of his specialized vocabulary, and started on the road that he's been on ever since. Up to that point, like many of us, he tried to be a good boy and listen to all the so-called experts and authorities who said you got to live this way and you got to do that. And that's when he decided to think for himself. And really began what he's been doing for the 45 years ever since. This is in several of his writings. It comes in from from time to time.
I was wondering whether he has written down any place his method, to the extent that one can write such a thing down, of using synergy for developing ideas. I mean, he has discussed synergy in the sense of defining universe and picking out social problems, but for actually designing something like a geodesic dome or the windmill or something else, has he actually set something down, a strategy for synergistic research?
I'm not sure that I can answer that one. I think, by the way, that one thing that you ought to do at the university is to get one or more copies of all of his books and the World Inventory, because a great deal of what you people are asking is there in writing. Well, I can't answer your question directly. It brings up another point that is a favorite of mine, which I learned from Bucky when we worked out in Wichita in the mid-40s, and has stood me in good stead in all kinds of situations, which I call turning adversity to advantage. I don't care whether it's in one's personal life, social life, business life, school life, or whatever. There's hardly a day comes up that something doesn't go wrong, and certainly a week or month when something important doesn't go wrong in one's life. And I find you're always faced with, you know, the disheartening idea of just accepting it and crawling into your shell or what have you, and that's that. And I have found that just the simple phrase of turning adversity to advantage, if you get your mind thinking, you can usually figure out a way that what's happened to you that's awful or bad can be turned around in your own development quite advantageously. And if that sounds rather odd, all I can say to you is try it and keep trying it, and you'll find it works.
I think there. I was going to ask you, is this book... is it Synergetics or Synergetic Geometry that's to be published? What's the name?
Synergetic Geometry. It's the whole basis of first let me tell you that I don't think there's 5% of it that I understand. I'm not a mathematician, and I'm not a very good mechanic. The book is a very detailed and technical explanation, really, of Bucky's mathematics, of his mathematics in terms of the universe, and it's going to be a highly debated volume among mathematicians, but it's the whole basis of all his work, whether it was the three-wheel car, the Dymaxion house, the dome, or any of his other basic thinking. And I personally think that it's going to become, you know, one of the important books of the century, along with Einstein's. because I think Bucky's basic discoveries about mathematics and the structure of the universe, which led him to geodesics, is that important.
There's been some mention in the utopian philosophy writings of Mr. Fuller, and I haven't yet found what his concept of utopia is. Could you refer me to one of his works that might include this, or give me a capsule summary of what he...
Well, Bucky doesn't believe in a utopia as, let's say, Edward Bellamy wrote. Bucky's point is that, you know, you don't reform man, you reform his environment. And when you reform his environment, as you, any living creature changes. Whether your environment is reformed by automobiles or by heating a building or by airplanes or whatever. Probably the one book that might fit best with what you're asking is his book entitled Utopia or Oblivion. I don't know how many of you read during the last month anything about this report of the Club of Rome, this absolute doomsday nonsense. Put out by these, backed by certain industrialists and so-called intellectuals in Europe, and then with money put up by the Volkswagen Foundation, they got some computer work done at MIT, and unfortunately, the report looks as if MIT thinks this is great, which isn't true at all. I mean, it's not an official document of the university. But the essence of that report is that there is not enough to go around, that we're going to use up all our resources, and that inevitably, man, it doesn't say this, but the implication is that inevitably, all the people on the earth are going to be fighting for the little resources that are left, and then obviously the big nations with all the military weapons are going to beat up every little nation there is, and that's the only way they're going to survive. Well, it's complete nonsense. And Bucky's point in terms of what you're asking is... And this comes through in his concept of what he calls world game as against the Pentagon and all war departments' use of what they call war game, is that there are enough resources to go around, that for the first time, in the history of mankind, that the world can be made to work for everybody, and that the use of the computer that was used at MIT for the Club of Rome report is correct. You should use a computer. They just fed in all the wrong material. They ignored recycling of materials, they ignored pollution controls that are possible, they ignored the fact of doing more with less in terms of new inventions, they ignored all the things that can make the world work. And I guess the simplest example, and I don't, to answer your point, is that we go up in an airplane. We go through fog. we sit in that plane, we may be a little nervous, but basically we know that the pilot and whoever on Earth is in touch with them, that by radar and by computers, we're going to be safe. Well, the same thing happens in our space program, and the same thing can happen in the proper use of the world's resources and making things work.
I just came from a discussion this evening at this Club of Rome, and the man who presented it to us indicated that there is another side to the story. What they did is they fed into the computer all of the possible alternatives, both negative and positive, and they got predictions for the future on the far optimistic as well as pessimistic side, and anything in between based on the alternatives fed into the computer.
Well, they did, but they didn't feed everything into the computer.
Yeah, I'm sure they must have.
This is a computer can't think for us.
No, your whole point is things are going to get so bad that people will turn around and start. Yeah, you're right with using Fuller's ideas. If people thought, they could do more with less. But on the current rates of consumption, even as she said with the optimistic view, it's going to happen. We're going to run out. Now, no, it's a moot point. It's just a matter of optimism. Will people do it or won't we? And I've never heard any political leaders mention, like Nixon, none of the world political leaders have mentioned it. The leaders of business certainly aren't doing anything.
Well, you're not going to get it from the political leaders. Let me...
Well, you're just so optimistic.
No, it's not a question of optimism. Bucky's point is that from his studies, from what the potentials are, from what is possible, it's not a question of being an optimist. You can be an optimist without any facts. That's an emotional state. His point is that the facts are there that indicate that you can make the world work. Now, he can't sit back and say, therefore, it is going to work. I can tell you that the only way it's going to work is if tens of thousands of people like yourself figure out how to make it work. The politicians won't. And I can tell you this because I've been in politics one way or another for 40 years. And this is the first year in the last 20 that I'm not going to be involved in any campaign because it's a damn waste of time. Now, I know that's exactly the wrong thing to say to young people, who everybody's telling them to get into politics. And I've been, I've run all of Senator Ribicoff's campaigns in Connecticut, two of them when he ran for governor, and I was executive aide to him when he was governor, and both his campaigns for the Senate. And I've been in campaigns since first fighting for Norman Thomas back in 1932. And when I sit back and look at all the things that we fought for then, many of which have happened, and then I walk through the slums of New York or the Bronx or Harlem, where the only thing that I don't understand is that the natives there don't burn everything down overnight. It's so incredibly awful. I know that politics isn't the way the world's going to work. And however phony Nixon is, and he is, he's only interested in himself and his reelection. The fact is that he's probably the best thing we've got, because we'll probably get rid of U.S. sovereignty quicker with him around than anybody else.
Are you talking about formal politics that isn't going to work, the formal structure we have now, or politics as a...
No, saying is that politics, I don't care if it's ours or a foreign government or what it is never going to do the job, because the form of politics, the way one governs, the whole method involved is not a method that can solve the kinds of problems that have to be solved. You've still got to have some form of a political organization. But the very nature of the way politics works can't bring about the kind of things that have to be done in the world.
Does it ever seem to you that a lot of our problems are caused by the things we ignore instead of the things we face?
Well, like what?
Like the global problem. They're ignoring all these facts.
Yeah, but I think you got to look behind it to why they're ignoring. That's right. There are two reasons they're ignoring them. One is ignorance, and the second is that I think many of the people behind it are worried about their wealth. They put this little game together for their own benefit.
Sure. So the answer is create a world where they can play their game and not hurt anybody. They like to play with money, let them play with it. Give them a big monopoly set.
Call it New York City.
I'm curious about, as Mr. Fuller's associate, 30-year associate, what exactly is your role? Are you an interpreter or a guardian?
I'm not an interpreter, and nobody's a guardian.
He's got a 45 in here.
No, I tried to say most of these 30 years I have not been with. After the Dymaxian House episode in Wichita, well, we built the house, but we were far too many years ahead of our time. I've spent most of the years since then in Connecticut and in public relations field, both in politics and business and labor and trade associations and so on. And about 3 years ago, I said to Bucky, all the stuff I'm doing is a bunch of nonsense. So I've been progressively spending more time with him since then. I get people look at me as if I'm somewhat nuts when I tell them that he happens to be the most important man alive on Earth today. I think this is true, which again is part of my answer. When you talk about politicians, there are very few politicians who are statesmen, and very few of them who are statesmen, who really are dedicated to something that makes sense over a long period of time. By the way, I didn't mean by what I said that many of the so-called politicians aren't fine people and doing things that are important. I just think that the other area is obviously more important. I don't know if I've answered what you asked, but one of the things that several of us are trying to do now is to put together some kind of an institute that will both preserve and promulgate many of Bucky's both materials and ideas. I mean by materials, his tapes, his books, his clippings, his all kinds of things, and to see that they are better disseminated and can be developed both in terms of the world game philosophy vis-a-vis the Club of Rome, his education ideas on campuses around the world, and so on. And as I said to you earlier this evening, you know, Bucky has a very intuitive feel in terms of places he is and so on. And while he's been to Alaska before, this was his first visit to Fairbanks. And I came along on this trip. I'm not with him usually. Partly because I felt that it would be important, and partly because I'd been up here before. My son was in Fairbanks. He's now in Anchorage and running legal services in the poverty program for the state. And Bucky had a feeling, we talked about it after his day here today, that he got the feeling that you people on this campus, I'd say these are my words now, not his, are in the, let's say, the top 10% of the campuses he visits in terms of the kind of interest and the kind of potential for developing a new educational ideas. And I think he felt this is true. I know he feels this way, for instance, about the University of Colorado, just to mention one other place. And I think he felt this way, you know, that Alaska still is a frontier, and obviously this means something to those of you who are here. I hope he's right. Otherwise, I wouldn't be sitting here at this point.
He decided to think for himself. Was there any kind of struggle before that? I mean, it's a terrible decision to think for yourself. Like, you know, you look for everything to stand on, and there's nothing. It's terrible. Did he go through anything like this?
Are you asking me to interpret further Bucky's life, or are you talking about yours?
I want to know what he felt like when he made this decision, or what preceded it. Are there any particular events that would be pertinent?
Well, I think there were two things, and I've forgotten. Did he talk last night about his being cross-eyed?
No.
Well, I think there were several things. One is that he was born cross-eyed. And the first few years of his life, I guess when his parents kept talking to the doctor about doing something about it, the doctor indicated you wait till a child is 3 or 4 and then you either try to do something, or I don't know. But in any case, he tells the story that I guess with his sister and playmates. In the early years of his life, because he was cross-eyed, he could not, I mean, everything was blurred. And as the kids were playing games or telling stories, he became the great storyteller, because from the blur, he kept making up all kinds of things, and he thought everyone else was making up things. They were telling what they saw, and he couldn't see anything, so he'd make it up. And not until he got glasses and began to see what life, you know, what was real, did he realize what his early years were. And then, when he had glasses, life took on a whole new feel. I mean, again, the business of just a flower or anything that he never could see before was, you know, it's almost like a blind person being cured became something great in the world. So this had a great effect in terms of his feeling of what was around him. Then his father died, and being, I guess, like many of us, a very dutiful child, every time his mother said, so-and-so is a friend of the family, listen to him, he listened. And he obviously found what I found, and what I think many of us find, that no matter how much anybody wants to help, they, at least half the time or more, they're giving you the wrong either the wrong information or the wrong advice. Well, all this added up from various activities to the point we're talking about when he decided to hell with it. If he was going to live, he was going to live his own life and start thinking for himself. And it was out of that and his prior experience, as I think I'm sure he referred last night to some of his naval experience, and that his whole philosophy began to develop.
I don't think you stand, I mean, very often stand at a crossroads in your life and say, here I am at a crossroads. You know, now I have this decision to make. It has to be probably retrospective when you look back and say, I made a decision there. Because I would think that usually you think you're thinking for yourself all the time until you look back and see that you weren't.
Well, I would say if you, unfortunately, there's certain of his writings you probably couldn't get hold of up here. Because they're somewhat out of print. But I heard Bucky in one of the sessions this afternoon refer to things he'd written about ecology 40 years ago. And I think you will see that from 1927 to 1932, you know, was a complete revolution in his life. And he did put out these magazines in the early 30s, which did give the whole basic philosophy that he has proceeded on ever since. So that I think this is perhaps quite different than the average person. Or I can only tell you, obviously, not that I claim as a person to be anything. You know, Bucky says he's just an average guy. Well, if he's an average guy, I'm, you know, way down here somewhere. But I think as we grow up, there are points in our life that we remember. I graduated from a private school on Long Island in a class of 13. And
that's 1913?
Not quite. 1929. And one of my classmates was the niece of the man who later went to the Supreme Court, Felix Frankfurter. Now, 1929 was the height of the Hoover prosperity, and this was in June. The Depression didn't hit until 3 or 4 months later, the stock market went to hell. And I can remember Felix Frankfurter standing on that stage, turning his back to the audience and saying, I'm not interested in you people out there. I'm interested in the 13 people on this stage. And he then proceeded to tell us, ignore authority, ignore the older generation that says they know everything and think for yourself and so on and so forth. So I can only say sometimes in our lives something does happen that is key to affecting what we do from that point on.
Maybe you've talked to this before, because I came in rather late, but I'll throw it out anyway. Mr. Fuller has indicated that he is a optimistic technologist. B.F. Skinner is an optimistic technologist, and Mr. Fuller has indicated that he would like to do some directing of change, and also Mr. Skinner is interested in directing change. Would you say that the two are compatible in the way that they would direct change?
This is an area I don't get into. I don't know that much about Mr. Skinner. What little I know is that the two are not compatible.
I think one of the differences between them is that Mr. Skinner's changing people by various techniques.
Yeah, I think your point's a very good one.
While Bucky is changing the technology around the people.
I think what you've just said about changing technology around the people rather than the people was part of my point in saying that that politics doesn't get very far, because the political field is involved in either trying to change or control people. And if you change the environment, why, this is far more basic.
How does he react then to Marshall McLuhan, who seems to be more in that general area?
Well, he and McLuhan are very good friends. Again, I'm not going to interpret how Bucky reacts. I don't think that's my role. I can only give you my own reaction, which is that McLuhan is doing a good job, but it's mostly the interpretive job with words put together very well, but it isn't the basic scientific work that Bucky has done.
Maybe I could ask you a fairly question that'd be kind of easy to answer. Could you give us sort of a description on Bucky's everyday life, like when he wakes up in the morning and brushes his teeth and stuff like that?
Yeah, I can. It's absolutely amazing. In the first place, I'm going to get a tape from you. There's no point in my fooling with this, which is stopped. No, I promised him that I would. I think, which is a good answer to what you just asked. I think that I haven't told him